Hopper Audio presents Winning by Jack Welch with Susie Welch. Read by Jack Welch. Introduction. Every day there's a new question. After I finished my autobiography, a fun but crazily intense grind that I wedged into the corners of my real job at the time, I swore I'd never write another book again. But I guess I did. My excuse, if there is one, is that I didn't actually come up with the idea for this book. It was given to me. It was a retirement present, if you will, from the tens of thousands of terrific people I have met since I left GE, the energized, curious, gutsy, and ambitious men and women who have loved business enough to ask me every possible question you could imagine. In order to answer them, all I had to do was figure out what I knew, sort it out, codify it, and borrow their stories, and this book was off and running. The questions I'm referring to first started during the promotional tour for my autobiography in late 2001 and through much of 2002, when I was overwhelmed by the emotional attachment people seemed to have for GE. From coast to coast and in many countries around the world, people told me touching stories about their experiences working for the company, or what happened when their sister, dad, aunt, or grandfather did. But with these stories, I was also surprised to hear how much more people wanted to know about getting business right. Radio call-in guests pressed me to explain GE's system of top 20, middle 70, and bottom 10, which separates employees into three performance categories and manages them up or out accordingly. People attending book signing events wanted to know if I really meant it when I said the head of human resources at every company should be at least as important as the CFO. And I did. At a visit to the University of Chicago Business School, an MBA from India asked me to explain more fully what a really good performance appraisal should look like. The questions didn't stop after the book tour. They continued in airports, restaurants, and elevators. Once a guy swam over to me in the surf off Miami Beach to ask me what I thought about a certain franchise opportunity he was considering. But mainly, they've come at the 150 or so Q&A sessions I've participated in over the past 3 years. In cities around the world, from New York to Shanghai, from Milan to Mexico City. In these sessions, which have ranged from 30 to 5,000 audience members, I sit on a stage with a moderator, usually a business journalist, and I try to answer anything the audience wants to throw at me. And throw they have. Questions about everything from coping with Chinese competition, to managing talented but difficult people, to finding the perfect job, to implementing Six Sigma, to hiring the right team, to leading in uncertain times, to surviving mergers and acquisitions, to devising a killer strategy. What should I do, I've heard, if I deliver great results, but I work for a jerk who doesn't seem to care, or if I'm the only person in my company who thinks change is necessary, or if the budget process in my company is full of sandbagging, or I'm about to launch a great new product and headquarters doesn't want to give me the autonomy and resources I need. What can I do, people have asked, if managers in my company don't really tell it like it is, or I have to let go of an employee I really like but who just can't hack it, or I have to lead my organization through the crisis we've been trying to deal with for a year. There have been questions about juggling the colliding demands of kids, career, and all that other stuff you want to do, like play golf, renovate your house, or raise money in a walkathon. There have been questions about landing the promotion of your dreams without making any enemies. There have been questions about macroeconomic trends, emerging industries, and currency fluctuations. There have been literally thousands of questions, but most of them come down to this. What does it take to win? And that is what this book is about, winning. Probably no other topic could have made me want to write again, because I think winning is great. Not good, great. Winning in business is great because when companies win, people thrive and grow. There are more jobs and more opportunities everywhere and for everyone. People feel upbeat about the future. They have the resources to send their kids to college, get better health care, buy vacation homes, and secure a comfortable retirement. And winning affords them the opportunity to give back to society in hugely important ways beyond just paying more taxes. They can donate time and money to charities and mentor in inner-city schools, to name just two. Winning lifts everyone it touches. It just makes the world a better place. When companies are losing, on the other hand, everyone takes a hit. People feel scared. They have less financial security and limited time or money to do anything for anyone else. All they do is worry and upset their families. In the meantime, if they're out of work, they pay little, if any, taxes. Let's talk about taxes for a minute. In fact, let's talk about government in general. Obviously, government is a vital part of society. First and foremost, it does nothing less than protect us all from the insidious and persistent challenges to national security that are with us now and for the foreseeable future. But government provides much more. The justice system, education, police and fire protection, highways and ports, welfare and hospitals. The list could go on and on. But even with the virtues of government, it's critical to remember that all of its services come from some form of tax revenue. Government makes no money of its own. And in that way, government is the support for the engine of the economy. It is not the engine itself. Winning companies and the people who work for them are the engine of a healthy economy. And in providing the revenues for government, they are the foundation of a free and democratic society. That's why winning is great. Now, it goes without saying that you have to win the right way, cleanly and by the rules. That's a given. Companies and people that don't compete fairly don't deserve to win. And thanks to well-honed internal company processes and government regulatory agencies, the bad guys are usually found and kicked out of the game. But companies and people in business that are honest, and that's the vast, vast majority, must find the way to win. This book offers a roadmap. It is not, incidentally, a roadmap just for senior-level managers and CEOs. If this book helps them, terrific. I hope it does. But this book is also very much for people on the front lines. Business owners, middle managers, people running factories, line workers, college graduates looking at their first jobs, MBAs considering new careers, and entrepreneurs. My main goal with this book is to help the people with ambition in their eyes and passion running through their veins, wherever they are in an organization. You will meet a lot of people in this book. Some may remind you of yourself. Some may just feel very familiar. There's the CEO who presents the company with a list of noble values, say quality, customer service, and respect, but never really explains what it means to live them. There's the middle manager who fumes during a meeting with another division of his company, knowing that his co-workers could do so much more if they just stopped patting themselves on the back for a minute. There is the employee who has been underperforming for years, but is just so friendly and nice and clueless, you can't bring yourself to let her go. There is the colleague you can't look in the eye because he's a dead man walking, slowly and painfully being managed out the door. There are the employees who eat lunch every day at what they have dubbed the Table of Lost Dreams, making a show of their resentment of authority. There's the engineer who spent 15 years building a great career, only to throw it in one day when she realized that she had juggled life and work to make everyone happy but herself. You'll also meet a lot of people whose stories are examples of innovation, insight, and grit. There's David Novak, the energetic young CEO of Yum Brands, who has turned every one of Yum's more than 33,000 restaurant chain outlets into a laboratory of new ideas and the entire organization into a learning machine. There's Dennis Naden, the consummate change agent, who never settles for good enough and has intensity to burn. There's Jimmy Dunn, who rebuilt his company out of the ashes of the World Trade Center using love, hope, and an attitude that anything is possible. There's Susan Peters, a working mother and the number two HR executive at GE, who could write a book herself on successfully navigating the hills and valleys of work-life balance. There is Chris Navetta, the CEO of U.S. Steel Cosis, who helped transform a struggling city in Slovakia while turning a former state-owned steel mill into a flourishing, profitable enterprise. There's Kenneth Yu, the head of 3M's Chinese operations, who catapulted his businesses from modest to high growth by throwing out the phony ritual of annual budgeting and replacing it with a sky's-the-limit dialogue about opportunities. There's Mark Little, who was devastated after a demotion at GE, but fought his way back to a huge promotion with courage, perseverance, and great results. People are everything when it comes to winning, and so this book is a lot about people. In some cases, the mistakes they've made, but more often their successes. But mostly this book is about ideas and the power of putting them into action. Now, at this point, there might be listeners out there who are skeptical. They're thinking, winning is just too nuanced and complex a topic to cover in 20 chapters. I don't care how many people and ideas are in this book. Yes, winning is nuanced and complex, not to mention brutally hard. But it also happens to be achievable. You can win, but to do that, you need to know what makes winning happen. This book offers no easy formulas. There are none. Depending on the chapter, this book does, however, give you guidelines to follow, rules to consider, assumptions to adopt, and mistakes to avoid. The strategy chapter provides a three-step process. The chapter on finding the right job offers you good signs and warning signals. There are also several themes you'll hear again and again. The team with the best players wins, so find and retain the best players. Don't overbrain things to the point of inaction. No matter what part of a business you're in, share learning relentlessly. Have a positive attitude and spread it around. Never let yourself be a victim. And for goodness sake, have fun. Yes, have fun. Business is a game, and winning that game is a total blast. The road ahead. Before we get started, a word on how this book is organized. It has four parts. The first, called Underneath It All, is conceptual. It certainly contains more management philosophy than most business people have time for on any given day, and certainly more than I ever thought about in one sitting when I was working the day shift. But there's a substructure of principles to my approach to business, and so I lay them out in this first part. In brief, the four principles are about the importance of a strong mission and concrete values, the absolute necessity of candor in every aspect of management, the power of differentiation, meaning a system based on meritocracy, and the value of each individual receiving voice and dignity. The next section of this book, Your Company, is about the innards of organizations. It's about mechanics, people, processes, and culture. Its chapters look at leadership, hiring, people management, letting people go, managing change, and crisis management. After Your Company comes Your Competition, the section of this book about the world outside your organization. It discusses how you create strategic advantages, devise meaningful budgets, grow organically, grow through mergers and acquisitions, and it attempts to demystify a topic that never ceases to intrigue and baffle people, the quality program Six Sigma. The next section of this book is called Your Career, and it's about managing the arc and quality of your professional life. It starts with a chapter on finding the right job, not just the first job, but the right job at any point in your career. It also includes a chapter on what it takes to get promoted, and another on a hard spot we all find ourselves in at one time or another, working for a bad boss. The last chapter of this section addresses the very human desire to have it all at the same time, which, as you already know, you can't really do. You can, however, know what your boss thinks about the matter, and you should, and that's one aspect of this chapter. The last section of this book is called Tying Up Loose Ends, and in it I answer 9 questions that did not fall into any of the above categories. They concern managing the China threat, diversity, the impact of new regulations like the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, and how business should respond to societal crises like AIDS. There's also a question there about how my successor, Jeff Immelt, is doing. In a word, great. The status of my golf game, and whether or not I think I'll go to heaven. Now that was a question that stopped me. As for the rest of the questions in this book, they didn't exactly stop me, but they did challenge me to think hard about what I believe and why. This book has a lot of answers, but not all, because business is always changing and the world is always changing. As a Dutch entrepreneur said to me last year, every day in life there's a new question. That's what keeps us going. There are new questions and new answers, too. In fact, I have learned almost as much about business since I left GE as when I worked there. I learned from every single question asked of me, and I hope my responses will help you learn, too. Now we're going to get into the 4 chapters of Underneath It All, starting with 1, Missions and Values. The subtitle of this chapter is So Much Hot Air About Something So Real. Bear with me, if you will, while I talk about mission and values. I say that because these two terms have got to be among the most abstract, overused, misunderstood words in business. When I speak with audiences, I'm frequently asked about them, usually with some level of panic over their actual meaning and relevance. In New York, I once got the question, can you please define the difference between a mission and a value, and also tell us what difference that difference makes? Business schools add to the confusion by having their students regularly write mission statements and debate values, a practice made even more futile for being carried out in a vacuum. Lots of companies do the same to their senior executives, usually in an attempt to create a noble-sounding plaque to hang in the company lobby. Too often, these exercises end with a set of generic platitudes that do nothing but leave employees directionless or cynical. Who doesn't know of a mission statement that reads something like, XYZ company values quality and service, or such and such company is customer driven? Tell me what company doesn't value quality and service or focus on its customers? And who doesn't know of a company that has spent countless hours in emotional debate only to come up with values that, despite the good intentions that went into them, sound as if they were plucked from an all-purpose list of virtues, including integrity, quality, excellence, service, and respect? Give me a break. Every decent company espouses these things. And frankly, integrity is just a ticket to the game. If you don't have it in your bones, you shouldn't be allowed on the field. By contrast, a good mission statement and a good set of values are so real, they smack you in the face with their concreteness. The mission announces exactly where you are going, and the values describe the behaviors that will get you there. Speaking of that, I prefer abandoning the term values altogether in favor of just behaviors. But for the sake of tradition, let's stick with the common terminology. First, then, about that mission. In my experience, an effective mission statement basically answers one question: how do we intend to win in this business? It does not answer, what were we good at in the old days? Nor does it answer, how can we describe our business so that no particular unit or division or senior executive gets pissed off? Instead, the question, how do we intend to win in this business, is defining. It requires companies to make choices about people, investments, and other resources, and it prevents them from falling into the common mission trap of asserting they will be all things to all people at all times. The question forces companies to delineate their strengths and weaknesses in order to assess where they can profitably play in the competitive landscape. Yes, profitably. That's the key. Even Ben & Jerry's, the crunchy granola, hippie Save the World ice cream company based in Vermont, has profitable growth and increasing value for stakeholders as one of the elements of its three-part mission statement, because its executives know that without financial success, all the social goals in the world don't have a chance. That's not saying a mission statement shouldn't be bold or aspirational. Ben & Jerry's, for instance, wants to sell all natural ice cream and euphoric concoctions and improve the quality of life locally, nationally, and internationally. That kind of language is great in that it absolutely has the power to excite people and motivate them to stretch. At the end of the day, effective mission statements balance the possible and the impossible. They give people a clear sense of the direction to profitability and the inspiration to feel they are part of something big and important. Take our mission at GE as an example. From 1981 through 1995, we said we were going to be the most competitive enterprise in the world by being number one or number two in every market, fixing, selling, or closing every underperforming business that couldn't get there. There could be no doubt about what this mission meant or entailed. It was specific and descriptive, with nothing abstract going on. And it was aspirational, too, in its global ambition. This mission came to life in a bunch of different ways. First off, in a time when business strategy was mainly kept in an envelope in headquarters, and any information about it was the product of the company gossip mill, we talked openly about which businesses were already number one and number two, and which businesses had to get repaired quickly or be gone. Such candor shocked the system, but it did wonders for making the mission real to our people. They may have hated it when business was sold, but they understood why. Moreover, we harped on the mission constantly, at every meeting, large and small. Every decision or initiative was linked to the mission. We publicly rewarded people who drove the mission and let go of people who couldn't deal with it for whatever reason, usually nostalgia for their business in the good old days. Now, it is possible that in 1981, we could have come up with an entirely different mission for GE. Say, after lots of debate and an in-depth analysis of technology, competitors, and customers, we had decided we wanted to become the most innovative designer of electrical products in the world. Or say we had decided that our most profitable route would have been to quickly and thoroughly globalize every business we had, no matter what its market position. Either of these two missions would have sent GE off on an entirely different road from the one we took. They would have required us to buy and sell different businesses than we did, or hire and let go of different people, and so forth. But technically, I have no argument with them as missions. They are concrete and specific. Without doubt, the electrical products mission would have come as a comfort to most people in GE. After all, that's what most thought we were. The global focus mission would have probably alarmed others. Rapid change usually does. A final word about missions, and it concerns their creation. How do you come up with one? To me, this is a no-brainer. You can get input from anywhere, and you should listen to smart people from every quarter. But setting the mission is top management's responsibility. A mission cannot and must not be delegated to anyone except the people ultimately held accountable for it. In fact, a mission is the defining moment for a company's leadership. It's the true test of its stuff. And now about those values. As I said earlier, values are just behaviors, specific, nitty-gritty, and so descriptive, they leave little to the imagination. People must be able to use them as marching orders because they are the how of the mission, the means to the end, winning. In contrast to the creation of a mission, everyone in the company should have something to say about values. Yes, that can be a messy undertaking. That's okay. In a small enterprise, everyone can be involved in debating them in all kinds of meetings. In a larger organization, it's a lot tougher. But you can use company-wide meetings, training sessions, and the like for as much personal discussion as possible, and the intranet for broader input. Getting more participation really makes a difference, giving you more insights and more ideas, and at the end of the process, most importantly, much more extensive buy-in. The actual process of creating values, incidentally, has to be iterative. The executive team may come up with a first version, but it should be just that, a first version. Such a document should go out to be poked and probed by people all over an organization, over and over again. And the executive team has to go out of their way to be sure they've created an atmosphere where people feel it's their obligation to contribute. Now, if you're in a company where speaking up gets you whacked, this method of developing values just isn't going to work. I understand that. And as long as you stay, you're going to have to live with that generic plaque in the front hall. But if you're at a company that does welcome debate, and many do, shame on you if you don't contribute to the process. If you want values and behaviors that you understand and can live yourself, you have to make the case for them. It's really in the nitty-gritty details. When I first became CEO, I was certainly guilty of endorsing vague, too cryptic values. For instance, in 1981, I wrote in the annual report that GE leaders must face reality and live excellence and feel ownership. These platitudes sure sounded good, but they had a long way to go toward describing real behaviors. By 1991, we had made a lot of progress. Over the course of the previous 3 years, more than 5,000 employees spent some portion of their time participating in the development of our values. The result was much more concrete. We printed them on laminated wallet cards. The text included imperatives, such as act in a boundaryless fashion, always searching for and applying the best ideas regardless of their source, and be intolerant of bureaucracy, and see change for the growth opportunity it brings. Of course, some of these behaviors required further explanation and interpretation. And we did that all the time, at meetings, during appraisals, and at the water cooler. Since leaving GE, I've realized how much further still we might have been able to push the discussion about values and behaviors. A year ago, I watched Jamie Dimon and Bill Harrison work together to develop values and behaviors for the new company created by the merger of Bank One and J.P. Morgan Chase. The document they used to open the dialogue came from Bank One, and it listed values and their corresponding behaviors with a level of detail I had never seen before. Take the value, we treat customers the way we would want to be treated. That's pretty tangible. But Bank One had literally identified the 10 or 12 behaviors that made that value come to life. Here are some. Never let profit-center conflicts get in the way of doing what is right for the customer. Secondly, give customers a good, fair deal. Great customer relationships take time. Do not try to maximize short-term profits at the expense of building those enduring relationships. Always look for ways to make it easier to do business with us. And communicate daily with your customers. If they're talking to you, they can't be talking to a competitor. Finally, don't forget to say thank you. Another value Bank One had was, we strive to be the low-cost provider through efficient and great operations. Some of the prescribed behaviors included, leaner is better, eliminate bureaucracy, cut waste relentlessly, operations should be fast and simple, value each other's time, invest in infrastructure. We should know our business best. We don't need consultants to tell us what to do. If this level of detail feels overwhelming and even doctrinaire to you, I can sympathize. When I first saw Jamie's single-spaced, 5-page values and behaviors document, I nearly fell over. But as I read it, I saw its power. With all the stories I've heard in the past few years from employees and companies around the world, I'm convinced you just cannot be too specific about values and their related behaviors. Beyond that, these values and behaviors have to be backed up. Clarity around values and behaviors is not much good unless it is backed up. To make values really mean something, companies have to reward the people who exhibit them and punish those who don't. Believe me, it'll make winning easier. I say that because every time we asked one of our high-performing managers to leave because he didn't demonstrate the values, and we said as much publicly, the organization responded incredibly well. In annual surveys over a decade, people would tell us that we were a company that increasingly lived its values. That made people even more committed to living them too. And as our employee satisfaction results improved, so did our financial results. And finally, it's in the connection between the mission and the values. A concrete mission is great, and values that describe specific behaviors are too. But for a company's mission and values to truly work together as a winning proposition, they have to be mutually reinforcing. It seems obvious, doesn't it, that a company's values should support its mission. But it's amazingly easy for that not to be the case. A disconnect between the parts of a company's framework is probably more a sin of omission than of commission, but it often happens. In the most common scenario, a company's mission and its values rupture due to the little crises of daily life and business. A competitor moves into town and lowers prices, and so do you, undermining your mission of competing on extreme customer service. Or a downturn hits, so you cut your advertising budget, forgetting your mission is to enhance and extend your brand. These examples of disconnections may sound minor or temporary, but when left unattended, they can really hurt a company. In fact, in the worst-case scenario, they can literally destroy a business. That's how I see what happened at Arthur Andersen and Enron. Arthur Andersen was founded almost a century ago with the mission to become the most respected and trusted auditing firm in the world. It was a company that prided itself on having the courage to say no, even if that meant losing a client. It succeeded by hiring the most capable, highest integrity CPAs and rewarding them for doing work that rightfully earned the confidence of corporations and regulators around the world. Then the boom times of the 1980s arrived, and Arthur Andersen decided they wanted to start a consulting business. That's where the excitement was, not to mention the big money. The company started hiring more MBAs and paying them the constantly escalating salaries that the consulting industry demanded. In 1989, the firm actually split into two divisions, a traditional accounting division called Arthur Andersen and Andersen Consulting. Both fell under one corporate umbrella called Andersen Worldwide. Rather than valuing conscientiousness, consulting firms generally encourage creativity and reward aggressive sales behavior, taking the customer from one project to the next. In the 90s in particular, there was a real cowboy mentality in the consulting industry, and the accounting side of Andersen felt the impact. Some of its accountants clearly got swept up in the momentum, letting go of the auditing business values that had guided them for so long. Throughout most of the 90s, Arthur Andersen was a firm at war with itself. The consulting business was subsidizing the auditing side and didn't like it. And you can be sure the auditing side wasn't crazy about the bravado of the consulting types. In these circumstances, how could people know the answer to questions like, what really is our mission? What values matter most? And how should we behave? Depending on which side of the firm you pledged allegiance to, your answer would be different. And that's ultimately why the partners ended up in court with each other, trying to figure out how to divide the firm's profits. Eventually, in 2002, the house collapsed, due in no small part to the disconnect between its mission and values. In many ways, the same kind of dynamic was behind the Enron collapse. In its prior life, Enron was a simple, rather mundane pipeline and energy company. Everyone was focused on getting gas from point A to point B cheaply and quickly, a mission they accomplished very well by having expertise in energy sourcing and distribution. Then, like Arthur Andersen, the company changed missions. Someone got the idea to turn Enron into a trading company. Again, the goal was faster growth. At Arthur Andersen, auditors wearing green eye shades were suddenly sharing office space with MBAs in Armani suits. At Enron, again, figuratively speaking, the guys in coveralls were suddenly riding the elevator with MBAs in suspenders. Enron's new mission meant it focused first on trading energy and then on trading anything and everything. That change was probably pretty exciting at the time, but obviously no one figured out and explicitly broadcast what values and corresponding behaviors would support such a heady goal. The trading desk was the place to be, and the pipeline and energy generation businesses got shoved to the background. Unfortunately, there were no processes to provide checks and balances for the suspenders crowd. And it was in that context, of no context, that Enron's collapse occurred. Like Arthur Andersen, this story of a mission and values disconnect ends with thousands of innocent people losing their jobs. What a tragedy. Now, this chapter opened with the observation that people in business talk a lot about mission and values, but too often the result is more hot air than real action. No one wants it that way, but the loftiness and the imprecision inherent in both terms always seem to make it end up like that. But there's too much to lose by not getting your mission straight and by not making your values concrete. I'm not saying your company will collapse in flames the way Arthur Andersen and Enron did. They are extreme examples of a mission and values meltdown. But I am saying your company will not reach anywhere near its full potential if all that is guiding it is a list of pleasant platitudes hanging on the lobby wall. Look, I realize defining a good mission and developing the values that support it takes time and enormous commitment. There'll be long, contentious meetings when you'd rather go home. There'll be email debates when you wish you could just go do real work. There'll be painful times when you have to say goodbye to people you really like who just do not get the mission or live its values. On days like those, You might wish your mission and value statements were vague and generic, but they can't be. Take the time, spend the energy, and make them real. The second chapter in this basic philosophy is entitled Candor. I call it the biggest dirty little secret in business. I've always been a huge proponent of candor. In fact, I talked it up to GE audiences for more than 20 years. But since retiring from GE, I've come to realize that I underestimated its rarity. In fact, I would call lack of candor the biggest dirty little secret in business. What a huge problem it is. Lack of candor basically blocks smart ideas, fast actions, and good people contributing all the stuff they've got. It's a killer. When you've got candor, and you'll never completely get it, mind you, everything just operates faster and better. Now, when I say lack of candor here, I'm not talking about malevolent dishonesty. I'm talking about how too many people, too often, instinctively don't express themselves with frankness. They don't communicate straightforwardly or put forth ideas looking to stimulate real debate. They just don't open up. Instead, they withhold comments or criticism. They keep their mouths shut in order to make people feel better or to avoid conflict. And they sugarcoat bad news in order to maintain appearances. They keep things to themselves, hoarding information. That's all lack of candor, and it's absolutely damaging. And yet, lack of candor permeates almost every aspect of business. In my travels over the past few years, I've heard stories from people at hundreds of different companies who describe the complete lack of candor they experience day to day in every type of meeting, from budget and product reviews to strategy sessions. People talk about the bureaucracy, layers, politicking, and false politeness that lack of candor spawns. They ask, how can they get their companies to be places where people put their views on the table, talk about the world realistically, and debate ideas from every angle? Most often, I hear that lack of candor is missing from performance appraisals. In fact, I hear about that so often that I always end up asking audiences for a show of hands to the question, how many of you have received an honest, straight-between-the-eyes feedback session in the last year where you came out knowing exactly what you have to do to improve and where you stand in the organization? On a good day, I get 20% of the hands up. Most of the time, it's closer to 10%. Interestingly, when I turn the question around and ask the audience how often they've given an honest, candid appraisal to their people, the numbers just don't improve much. Forget outside competition when your worst enemy is the way you communicate with one another internally. What is the candor effect? Let's look at how candor leads to winning. There are three main ways. First and foremost, candor gets more people in the conversation. And when you get more people in the conversation, to state the obvious, you get idea rich. By that I mean many more ideas get surfaced, discussed, pulled apart, and improved. Instead of everyone shutting down, everyone opens up and learns. Any organization or unit or team that brings more people in their minds into the conversation has an immediate advantage. Second, candor generates speed. When ideas are in everyone's face, they can be debated rapidly, expanded, enhanced, and acted upon. That approach, surface, debate, improve, decide, isn't just an advantage. It's a necessity in a global marketplace. You can be sure that any upstart five-person enterprise down the street, or in Shanghai, or in Bangalore, can move faster than you can to begin with. Candor is one of the ways you can keep up. Third, candor cuts costs. Lots. Although you'll never be able to put a precise number on it. Just think of how it eliminates the meaningless meetings and the BS reports that confirm what everyone already knows. Think of how candor replaces fancy PowerPoint slides and mind-numbing presentations and boring off-site conclaves with real conversations, whether they are about company strategy, a new product introduction, or someone's performance. Put all of its benefits and efficiencies together, and you realize you just can't afford not to have candor. So why not? Why don't you? Given the advantages of candor, you have to wonder, why don't we have more of it? Well, the problem starts young. The facts are we are socialized from childhood to soften bad news or to make nice about awkward subjects. That is true in every culture and in every country and in every social class. It doesn't make any difference if you are in Iceland or Portugal. You don't insult your mother's cooking or call your best friend fat or tell an elderly aunt that you hated her wedding gift. You just don't. What happened at a suburban cocktail party we attended recently is classic. Over white wine and sushi rolls, one woman standing in a cluster of five others started lamenting the horrible stress being endured by the local elementary school's music teacher. Other guests chimed in, all agreeing that fourth graders were enough to send you to the insane asylum. Fortunately, just before the music teacher was canonized, another guest entered the conversation saying, "Are you guys crazy? That teacher gets 15 weeks a year off." She pointed to the doctor standing in the circle, who had been nodding away in agreement. "Robert," she said, "you make life and death decisions every day. Surely you don't buy this sad story, do you?" Talk about killing polite chit-chat. The new guest sent everyone scattering, mostly toward the bar. Candor just unnerves people. That was a light-hearted example, of course. But when you try to understand candor, you're really trying to understand human nature. For hundreds of years, psychologists and social scientists have studied why people don't say what they mean, and philosophers have been reflecting on the same subject for literally thousands of years. A good friend of mine, Nancy Bauer, is a professor of philosophy at Tufts University. When I ask her about candor, she tells me that most philosophers have come to the same conclusion on this topic as most of us laypeople do with age and experience. Eventually, you come to realize that people don't speak their minds because it's simply easier not to. When you tell it like it is, you can so easily create a mess: anger, pain, confusion, sadness, resentment. To make matters worse, you then feel compelled to clean up that mess, which can be awful and awkward and time-consuming. That's why Nancy says philosophers like Aristotle and Immanuel Kant believe that lack of candor has nothing to do with preventing sadness or pain in another person or with being kind or decent. In fact and in practice, it's all about self-interest, making your own life easier. Nancy, my philosophy friend, told me something else Kant had to say. He said that people lack candor because when you speak your mind and the news isn't good, you stand a strong chance of becoming unpopular. Most human beings, Kant said, will do almost anything to escape that fate. The irony, he said, is that in avoiding candor in order to be liked, people actually destroy trust, and in doing so, ultimately erode a good society. I tell Nancy the same could be said about eroding good businesses. From Aristotle and Kant to now, the make-or-break importance of candor in U.S. business is relatively new, actually. Up until the early 1980s, big companies like GE and thousands of others operated largely without it, as did most companies, regardless of size. These companies were a product of the military-industrial complex that grew up after World War II. They had virtually no global competition, and in fact, companies within industries were so similar to one another, they could often seem more collegial than competitive. Take the steel industry. Every 3 years or so, union workers across several companies would demand higher pay and benefits. The steel companies would meet those demands, passing their increased costs onto the automotive industry, which would pass their increased costs onto the consumer. It was a nice party until the Japanese arrived at the door with their average quality, low-cost imported cars that within a few years became high-quality, low-cost cars, many of them made in non-union U.S. factories. But until the foreign threat spread, most American companies had very little to do with the kind of frank debate and fast action that characterizes a candid organization. They had little use for it, and so countless layers of bureaucracy and old-fashioned social codes of behavior led to a kind of enforced politeness and formality throughout most organizations. There were very few overt confrontations about strategy or values. Decisions were made mostly behind closed doors. And when it came to appraisals, those too were conducted with a kind of courteous remoteness. Good performers were praised, but because companies were so financially strong, poor performers could be warehoused in a far-flung department or division until retirement. Without candor, everyone saved face, and business lumbered along. The status quo was accepted, fake behavior was just a day at the office, and people with initiative, gumption, and guts were labeled troublesome or worse. You would predict, perhaps, that given all its competitive advantages, candor would have made a grand entrance with the Japanese. But Japan didn't make it happen, nor did Ireland, Mexico, India, or China, to name a few of the big hitters in the global marketplace today. Instead, most companies have fought global competition through more conventional means, layoffs, drastic cost reductions, and in the best cases, with innovation. Candor, while inching its way in, still remains a very small part of the arsenal. But it can be done. Now for the really bad news. Even though candor is vital to winning, it is hard and time-consuming to instill in any group, no matter what size. It's hard because you're fighting human nature and entrenched organizational behaviors, and time-consuming, as in years and years. At GE, it took us close to a decade to use candor as a matter of course, and it was by no means universal after 20. Still, it can be done. There's nothing scientific about the process. To get candor, you reward it, praise it, and talk about it. You make public heroes out of people who demonstrate it. Most of all, you yourself demonstrate it in an exuberant, even exaggerated way, even when you're not the boss. Imagine yourself for a second at a meeting where the subject is growth and how to get it at an old-line division. Everyone's sitting around the table, civilly talking about how hard it is to win in this particular market or industry. They discuss the tough competition. They surface the same old reasons why they can't grow and why they're actually doing well in this environment. In fact, by the time the meeting ends, they've managed to pat themselves on the back for the success they've enjoyed under the circumstances. Inside your head, you're about ready to burst as you tell yourself, here we go again. I know Bob and Mary across the room feel the same way I do. The complacency around here is killing us. Outside, all three of you are playing the game. You're nodding. Now imagine an environment where you take responsibility for candor. You, Bob, or Mary would ask questions like, isn't there a new product or service idea in this business somewhere that we just haven't thought of yet? Can we jumpstart this business with an acquisition? Or, this business is taking up so many resources. Why don't we get the hell out of it? What a different meeting. What a lot more fun, and how much better for everyone. Another situation that happens all the time is a high-growth business with a self-satisfied crowd managing it. You know the scene at the long-range planning meeting. The managers show up with double-digit growth, say 15%, and pound out slide after slide, showing how well they are doing. Top management nods their approval, but you're sitting there knowing there's a lot more juice in that business. To compound matters, the people presenting the slides are peers of yours, and there's that age-old code hanging in the air. If you don't challenge mine, I won't challenge yours. Frankly, the only way I know of to get out of this bind and introduce candor is to poke around in a non-threatening way. Geez, you're good. What a terrific job. This is the best business we've got. Why not put more resources into it and go for more? With the great team you've got in place, there must be 10 acquisitions out there for you. Have you looked globally? Those questions, and others like them, have the power to change the meeting from a self-congratulatory parade to a stimulating working session. Now, you may be thinking, I can't raise those questions because I don't want to look like a jerk. I want to be a team player. It is true that candid comments definitely freak people out at first. In fact, the more polite or bureaucratic or formal your organization, the more your candor will scare and upset people. And yes, it could kill you. That's a risk, and only you can decide if you're willing to take it. Needless to say, you'll have an easier time of installing candor in your organization if you are closer to the top. But don't blame your boss or the CEO if your company lacks candor. Open dialogue can start anywhere. I was speaking my mind when I had 4 employees at Narell, the smallest, newest unit of a hierarchical company that had a very dim view of straight talk. I was too young and politically clueless to notice at the time, but I was covered because our business was growing by leaps and bounds. If we had the guts to be candid, it didn't feel that way at the time. We didn't know enough to know what candor was. It just felt natural to us to speak openly, argue and debate, and get things to happen fast. If we were anything, it was crazily competitive. Every time I got promoted, the first cycle of reviews, be it budgets or appraisals, was often awkward and unpleasant. Most of the new team I was managing wasn't used to wide-open discussions about everything and anything. For example, we'd be talking about a direct report at a personnel review, and in conversation we would agree that the guy was really awful. His written appraisal, however, made him look like a prince. When I challenged the phoniness out here, yeah, but why would we ever put that in writing? I'll explain why, making the case for candor. By the next review, we'd already be seeing candor's positive impact with a better team in place. And with each successive cycle, more and more people made Kansas' case with me. Still, it wasn't like I was singing with the whole chorus. From the day I joined GE to the day I was named CEO 20 years later, my bosses cautioned me about my candor. I was labeled abrasive and consistently warned that my candor would soon get in the way of my career. Well, now my career is over, and I'm telling you that it was candor that helped make it work. So many people got into the game, so many voices, so much energy. We gave it to one another straight, and each of us was better for it. Now, we've talked a lot in this chapter about one word, but it's really very simple. Candor works because candor unclutters. Yes. Everyone agrees that candor is against human nature. So is waking up at 5 in the morning for the 6:10 train every day. So is eating lunch at your desk so you won't miss an important meeting at 1. But for the sake of your team or your organizations, you do a lot of things that aren't easy. The good thing about candor is that it's an unnatural act that is more than worth it. It's impossible to imagine a world where everyone goes around saying what they really think all the time. And you probably wouldn't want it anyway. Too much information. But even if we get halfway there, lack of candor wouldn't be the biggest dirty little secret in business anymore. Instead, it would be its biggest change for the better. The third chapter in this fundamental management philosophy is differentiation. Some people have called it cruel and Darwinian. My suggestion is try fair and effective instead. If there's one of my values that really pushes buttons, it is differentiation. Some people love the idea. They swear by it. run their companies with it and will tell you it is at the very root of their success. Other people hate it. They call it mean, harsh, impractical, demotivating, political, unfair, or all the above. Once during a radio talk show about my first book, a woman in L.A. pulled off the highway to call in and label differentiation cruel and Darwinian. And that was just the beginning of her commentary. Obviously, I'm a huge fan of differentiation. I've seen it transform companies from mediocre to outstanding. And it is as morally sound as a management system can be. It works. Companies win when their managers make a clear and meaningful distinction between top and bottom performing businesses and people. When they cultivate the strong and cull the weak. Companies suffer when every business and person is treated equally and bets are sprinkled all around like rain on the ocean. When all is said and done, differentiation is just resource allocation, which is what good leaders do and, in fact, is one of the chief jobs they are paid to do. A company has only so much money and managerial time. Winning leaders invest where the payback is highest. They cut their losses everywhere else. If that sounds Darwinian, let me add that I am convinced that along with being the most efficient and most effective way to run your company, differentiation also happens to be the fairest and kindest. Ultimately, it makes winners out of everyone. When I was at GE, people discussed differentiation vigorously. But over the years, most people came to strongly support it as our way of doing business. By the time I retired, differentiation was not really a hot topic anymore. The same can't be said for outside the company. Without a doubt, differentiation receives the most questions I get from audiences around the world. As I said, people tend to love it or hate it, but a pretty large number are just confused by it. If I could change one thing about my first book, it would be to add more pages to the discussion of differentiation, explain the topic inside and out, and stressing that differentiation cannot and must not be implemented quickly. At GE, it took us about a decade to install the type of candor and trust that makes differentiation possible. But this chapter is not about implementation. It's about why I believe in differentiation. And why you should too. One of the main misunderstandings about differentiation is that it is only about people. That's to miss half of it. Differentiation is a way to manage people and businesses. Basically, differentiation holds that a company has two parts, software and hardware. Software is simple. It's your people. Hardware depends. If you're a large company, your hardware is the different businesses in your portfolio. If you are smaller, your hardware is your product lines. Let's look first at differentiation in terms of hardware. It's pretty straightforward and a lot less incendiary. Every company has strong businesses or product lines and weak ones and some in between. Differentiation requires managers to know which is which and invest accordingly. To do that, of course, you have to have a clear-cut definition of strong. At GE, strong meant a business was number one and number two in its market. If it wasn't, the managers had to fix it, sell it, or as a last resort, close it. Other companies have put forward different frameworks for investment decisions. They put their money and time only into businesses or product lines that promise double-digit sales growth, for instance. Or they invest only in businesses or product lines with a 15% or better discounted rate of return. Now, I generally don't like investment criteria that are financial in nature, like DCRR, because the numbers can be jiggered so easily by changing the residual value or any other number of assumptions in an investment proposal. But my point is the same. Differentiation among your businesses or product lines requires a transparent framework that everyone in the company understands. People may not like it, but they know it and they manage with it. In fact, differentiation among businesses and product lines is a powerful management discipline in general. At GE, the number one or number two framework stopped the decades-long practice of sprinkling money everywhere. Most GE managers in the old days probably knew that spreading money all around didn't make sense, but it's so easy to do. There's always that pressure, managers jockeying and politicking for their share of the pie. To avoid warfare, you give everyone a little slice and hope for the best. Companies also sprinkle money evenly for sentimental or emotional reasons. GE hung on to a marginally profitable central air conditioning business for 20 years because people thought it was necessary in order to have a full-line major appliance company. In reality, headquarters hated air conditioning because its success was so dependent on the installers. These independent contractors would put our machines into homes and then drive off, and GE lost control of the brand. Worse, we had a small share of the market and just couldn't make much money on central air conditioning. With the number one or number two framework, we had to sell the business. And when we did, to a company that lived and breathed air conditioning very successfully, GE's former employees discovered the joy of being loved. Moreover, management attention was no longer diverted to an underperforming business, and share owners had better returns. Everybody won. Running your company without differentiation among your businesses or product lines may have been possible when the world was less competitive. But with globalization and digitization, forget it. Managers at every level have to make hard choices and live by them. Now for the people part. Now let's talk about the more controversial topic, differentiation among people. It's a process that requires managers to assess their employees and separate them into three categories in terms of performance: the top 20%, the middle 70%, and the bottom 10%. Then, and this is key, it requires managers to act on that distinction. I emphasize the word act because all managers naturally differentiate in their heads, but very few make it real. When people differentiation is real, the top 20% of employees are showered with bonuses, stock options, praise, love, training, and a variety of rewards to their pocketbooks and their souls. There can be no mistaking the stars at a company that differentiates. They are the best and are treated that way. The middle 70 are managed differently. This group of people is enormously valuable to any company. You simply cannot function without their skills, energy, and commitment. After all, they are the majority of your employees. And that's the major challenge and risk in 20-70-10, keeping the middle 70 engaged and motivated. That's why so much of managing the middle 70 is about training, positive feedback, and thoughtful goal setting. If individuals in this group have particular promise, they should be moved around among businesses and functions to increase their experience and knowledge and to test their leadership skills. To be clear, managing the middle 70 is not about keeping people out of the bottom 10. It's not about saving poor performers. That would be a bad investment decision. Rather, differentiation is about managers looking at the middle 70, identifying people with potential to move up, and cultivating them. But everyone in the middle 70 needs to be motivated and made to feel as if they truly belong. You do not want to lose the vast majority of your middle 70. You want to improve them. As for the bottom 10% in differentiation, there's no sugarcoating this. They have to go. That's more easily said than done. It's awful to fire people. I even hate that word. But if you have a candid organization with clear performance expectations and a performance evaluation system, a big if, obviously, but that should be everyone's goal, then people in the bottom 10% generally know who they are. When you tell them, They usually leave before you ask them to. No one wants to be in an organization where they aren't wanted. One of the best things about differentiation is that people in the bottom 10% of organizations very often go on to successful careers at companies and in pursuits where they truly belong and where they can excel. That's how differentiation works in a nutshell. People sometimes ask where I came up with the idea. My answer is I didn't invent differentiation. I learned it on the playground when I was a kid. When we were making a baseball team, the best players always got picked first. The fair players were put in the easy positions, usually second base or right field. And the least athletic ones had to watch from the sidelines. Everyone knew where he stood. The top kids wanted desperately to stay there and got the reward of respect and the thrill of winning. The kids in the middle worked their tails off to get better, and sometimes they did, bringing up the quality of play for everyone. And the kids who couldn't make the cut usually found other pursuits, sports and otherwise, that they enjoyed and excelled at. Not everyone can be a great ball player. And not every great ball player can be a great doctor, computer programmer, carpenter, musician, or poet. Each one of us is good at something, and I just believe we are happiest and most fulfilled when we're doing that. It's true on the playground, and it's true in business. Now, there are several reasons to hate differentiation or not. I could spend the next couple of pages explaining all the reasons to love differentiation, but instead I'm going to list the most common criticism the concept receives. I'm leaving aside hardware differentiation here because it doesn't get anything like the heat that 2070-10 does. So here are some of the criticisms of people differentiation. Some have truth in them, but more often than not, they don't. Here's what I mean. Differentiation is unfair because it's always corrupted by company politics. 2070-10 is just a way of separating who kiss the boss's rear from those who don't. It's true, without question, that some companies, differentiation is corrupted by cronyism and favoritism. The top 20% are the boss's head nodders and buddies, and the bottom 10% are the outspoken types who ask difficult questions and challenge the status quo. The middle 70 are just ducking and getting by. That happens and it stinks. And it is a function of a leadership team lacking in brains or integrity or both. The only good thing I can say about a merit-free system like this is that eventually it destroys itself. It collapses from its own weight or has to change. The results just won't be good enough to sustain the enterprise. Luckily, cases of differentiation abuse can generally be prevented by a candid, clear-cut performance system with defined expectations and goals and timelines and a program of consistent appraisals. In fact, differentiation can be implemented only after such a system is in place, a process that we will discuss more specifically in the chapter on people management. A second complaint about differentiation is that it is mean and bullying. It's like the playground in the worst possible way. Weak kids are made into fools, outcasts, and objects of ridicule. Man, have I heard this 100 times, and it drives me crazy, because one of the major advantages of differentiation is that it is good and fair to everyone. When differentiation is working, people know where they stand. You know if you have a strong shot at a big promotion or if you need to be looking for other opportunities inside or outside the company. Maybe some information is hard to swallow at first. And yes, bad news often hurts. But soon enough, like all knowledge, it's power. In fact, it's liberating. When you know where you stand, you can control your own destiny. And what is more fair than that? Interestingly, when people raise this criticism with me at speaking engagements, I often ask them a question back. I ask if they ever receive grades in school. Naturally, everyone says yes. I then ask, did you think getting grades was mean? Well, no, they usually say. Sometimes grades sting, but kids somehow always live through it. And grades have a way of making everything pretty clear. Some people graduate and go on to be astronauts or research scientists or college professors. Others become marketing managers or advertising executives. And still others become nurses, chefs, or even professional surfers. Grades, in fact, guide us, telling us something about ourselves that we need to know. So why should we stop getting grades at age 21? To prevent meanness? Please.